Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
This is Kevin O'Brien of EWTN's Theater of the Word. I'm excited also to teach middle school and high school literature, speech, and drama with homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. Your student can meet with me online for a live, interactive class. Whether you take apologetics with John Martinoni, or grade school with Jackie De La Viaga, or any of the other 400-plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, online Catholic learning for your homeschooling family is available for you.
This episode is brought to you by Hallo, the number one Catholic app. Hallo has 1,000 audio-guided prayers and meditations for you to deepen your relationship with God. To listen to all of the Hallo meditations for free for 30 days, head to hallo.com/breadbox.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to be back with Trent Horn, who's been so busy. You're a busy person, Trent. You're a hardworking person, though. I mean, when I used to work in the same building with you, we don't work in the same building now anymore. But when we worked in the same building, I just tried to look busy when you were around, just so by comparison, I wouldn't look bad. You know, I was like, just moving paper around and acting like I was reading.
Well, I would look at your computer, Cy. That would explain something, because I thought you were just doing weird dialectic poetry. It was just all abacadabra on your laptop.
Yeah, well, that's
I guess you were just pretending to type.
I would be like ASDFJKLSemi, ASDFJKLSemi. I wasn't typing. I was just hitting those,
At least you could do lorem ipsum. Dolorum, you know, like the placeholder text.
Right.
At least that might fool the eye.
No, I'm so glad you're out of here, so I don't look as bad as I looked. But Trent Horn podcast, the Council of Trent, where you can find at trenthornpodcast.com. It really is just blossoming. Lots and lots of people listening.
Oh yeah, we're getting a lot of listens, and I'm excited about the future of the podcast. Actually, well, I'll let people know now, actually.
What?
A little bit of teaser. Yeah.
What? About to make some news here? I didn't even know.
Yeah. So this, you'll see this next week. So we have the episodes that are going to air this week. Next week, I'm going to start airing the episodes on our Council of Trent YouTube page. And so what's neat about them is I'll have the audio, but I will also have video of me and corresponding PowerPoint slides of what I'm talking about.
Oh, that is awesome. But wait a second. I paused there for a minute because it can kind of confuse me, because some of your stuff, Trent, I don't know if you know this, it's behind a paywall. Like, you have sponsors.
Right.
So is what will happen with the YouTube stuff with that, with those?
Oh, well, they will still get access to other things like our catechism study series, the ability to submit questions for open mailbag episodes, exclusive ability to comment, get a Council of Trent mug. All of that stuff is at trenthornpodcast.com. But the podcast is out there, and I wanted to share the podcast on YouTube. I didn't want to just put the audio up because I was like, oh, why? What's the purpose of that work? You know, I don't really like doing that. I mean, it would still serve people. But I've included PowerPoint slide elements to make the episodes more informative and engaging, to really make use of that. I'm not going to do YouTube if it's just for audio. Like, I want to use the video elements wisely. So I've already recorded a free-for-all Friday and an hour-long episode on a controversial social issue. You'll find out when it drops. And then I have one more to work through. But my goal is to, do them all on YouTube as well, and to expand that way.
I have an announcement too. Catholic Answers Focus will now be doing PowerPoint slides on YouTube. Right, Nick? Come make me some PowerPoint slides. I cannot compete with this if I don't have PowerPoint. All right. Yes, Catholic Answers Focus will now have PowerPoint slides on our YouTube page.
It's just white backgrounds with 12 point black font.
And we're going to use better fonts. All right, so there's
a 12-point font, white background, yellow text.
Stop upping your game, Trent. You'll
try not to do that.
Let's go to Noah in Westmont, Illinois, watching on YouTube Live. Noah, delighted to have you. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on. So I've heard from you guys and various other Catholic speakers that the mixed genitalia or mixed chromosomes in intersex people are ultimately a result of the disorderment of the fall. And I'm trying to learn how, like, I should converse with a family member of mine who is very much like transgenderism and homosexual affirming. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, mm-hmm. And because I don't know much about like the science and the research behind intersex, and she is much more knowledgeable than I am and has taken a lot of classes on it.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if this is true, that it is disordered from the fall. Like, which, how do you tell which gender they were supposed to have been? Like, had they not been affected that way? Like, there's people with, you know, that have XXY chromosomes. I'm like, is it supposed to be XX right. or XY? You know, which one is not supposed to be there? And like, and how do those people, how should they identify themselves, or what should they call themselves in those cases? Like, because that's a common argument I know, like, from people from that camp.
Got it, Noah. Thank you.
Right. So a few thoughts on that. First, it's very important to make a distinction between intersex cases and transgender identity. So intersex involves the question of what someone's biological sex is, whether they are male or female. And usually it involves some kind of a misalignment between their genetic chromosomes and their between their genotype, their genes, and their phenotype, or the development of their secondary sex characteristics. This can take on a variety of forms, like the inability to process androgens, which can make men actually appear very female, even though they have a male genotype, like complete androgen insensitivity syndrome. This can also just take the place with ambiguous genitalia in some infants. But you can still, on many of these cases, do a genetic karyotype test, and you can still see if they're XX or XY. But first, you need to distinguish it. So that's just about the biology, whether you're male or female. Transgender is about whether your sense of male or female corresponds with your biology. And I would say in 99% of cases, a person who identifies as transgender is not intersex. In the vast majority of cases, those people who identify as transgender, it is very clear biologically whether they are a man or a woman. So I wouldn't be concerned about, you know, I would say the issues are separate, that we could have discussions about intersex issues at one point, but transgender ideology stands or falls on its own. It's not connected to intersex in an essential way. So I would say, look, you could bracket it and just say transgender people have almost always the correct chromosomes and the secondary sex characteristics. They are, for all biological purposes, a man or a woman, except for what they claim. Now, with intersex, there are even in cases where someone has ambiguous genitalia, there are many things to help us determine, not necessarily whether they were supposed to be a man or a woman, but to determine they are a man or they are a woman. They just may have some kind of stunted development. And I would say, when we talk about the fall, we're not saying these intersex people are fallen from the fall and we're all not. We all have bodily ailments that are a result of being fallen creatures. So we will have genetic abnormalities, variations. Some of us may be born with disfigurements or other genetic predispositions. It affects all of us. But even with intersex, I would say in the vast majority of cases of so-called intersex, even with the chromosomes that are different, we know whether this is a man or a woman. So the most common examples would be Turner syndrome, which is where you only have 45 chromosomes. Instead of XX, which is 46 for women, XX, you have just a single X. And so that would be Turner syndrome. You're a biological female, but you tend to struggle with infertility and stunted secondary sex characteristics. Klinefelter is the other common one. That would be XXY, and that's a biological male. And there are others that show up, XYY, triple XY. When I've studied these, it seems clear that when the Y chromosome shows up, it seems very clear this person is a biological male, but the presence of the other X's seems to impact their fertility and some of their development. But I would say that there are there are only a tiny sliver, a minority of cases where it's really, really difficult. I've read one, I've only found one of someone that was XXY that was capable of giving birth to a child. It's a rare, rare case, and it may be hard to determine whether we have a man or a woman here. But I would say that the cases where we are not sure do not disprove the vast majority of cases where we are sure. Much the same way, there are cases where we're not sure if somebody is alive or dead. Like, they seem brain dead, but they're not. And so we're like, well, are they alive or are they dead? Oh, we're not sure. But that doesn't mean we can't tell 99.9% of the time whether someone's alive or dead. It's biology. We can tell that.
And it also doesn't mean there's no difference between death and life. It doesn't mean that.
Right. It doesn't mean there's no difference either. There certainly is. So, Noah, I would recommend if you would like – actually, Noah and all of our listeners, here's what I would recommend. Go to Barnes & Noble, not Amazon. Go to Barnes & Noble or go directly to the publisher. I think it's Regnery. I'm not sure. And get Ryan Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally, A Response to the Transgender Movement. So the book is When Harry Became Sally, A Response to the Transgender Movement. Go get it now at Barnes & Noble while you can, because Amazon has just stopped selling the book. They have just stopped. Probably because people complain and say it's hate speech when it isn't. So that is very concerning. So get the book while you can, while it's available for purchase from book dealers. Go to get When Harry Became Sally by Ryan Anderson. I think that'd be very helpful. So Noah, is that a helpful reply?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out. So ultimately, just to clarify what you're saying, and I really appreciate all of that from someone who doesn't know a lot about it, and it's been kind of a point of contention, sort of.
Sure.
So you're saying that ultimately it's like the fact that those extra chromosomes, however they come in, are just a result of the disorderment. Like that was just how they happened to have been affected, basically, right? As no different than someone else is affected by the fall.
Right. Like somebody might get trisomy 21 or Down syndrome, or other people may have a genetic abnormality that produces something that's beneficial or not beneficial. So I would just say that we all have genetic variances, but we still know there are men and there are women, and men can't become women. And with this person who defends transgender ideology, Noah, you should ask them, actually, stay on the line, give your email to our call screener. I'll send you an article I wrote on tough questions for transgender advocates. So, for example, you could ask your friend Noah, okay, well, what is a woman? What is a man? They're not the same thing. If you say a transgender woman is a man, people will want to string you up in modern culture. But they know men and women are different. And I would ask them, well, what is a woman? What is a man? And you can't define it objectively without recourse to biology, which shows transgender ideology simply doesn't work. So I hope that's helpful for you. I'll send you the email. And our listeners, get When Harry Became Sally when you can.
And Noah, if you give your email address to Marie, we'll get it to Trent, and you can have that communication. This has nothing to do with Trent's announcement about his podcast, but I just want to announce that our podcast here, Catholic Answers Live on YouTube, will now have pictures of cats. It is nothing. I'm not trying to show Trent up. I'm just saying that our podcast will now have pictures of cats. We're going to take a quick break, right back with more Open Forum right after this.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
How should we pray? The disciples asked our Lord that question, and he gave them the Our Father, or the Lord's Prayer. But he also gave them the liturgy, which is the most privileged form of prayer in the Catholic tradition, especially the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. We can pray with the whole church in the liturgy of the hours, or the Divine Office, and we should also pray in our own private room, our secret chamber, as Jesus says, and then our Father who sees us in secret will reward us.
I think if you pray and you say to the Lord, I don't understand, thy will be done. That's a prayer of faith. If something wonderful happens and I say, thank you, Lord, that's a prayer of thanksgiving. If you're distressed and you say, Lord, help me, I can't do anything about this, that's a prayer of hope. And you say, Lord, I can't take one more thing. That's a prayer of desperation. If you're talking to him about it, that's prayer.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Trent Horn, our guest, making some news this hour with us. Trent Horn podcast about to be available on YouTube with PowerPoint slides. We also making some news here at Catholic Answers Live. Our podcast will now include pictures of cats. Our number is 888-318-7884. Trent Horn is an apologist extraordinaire, author of a whole bunch of books, including Persuasive Pro-Life, Answering Atheism, Why We're Catholic, and a whole bunch more. You're welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884. They haven't gone easy on you today. Big questions today about big, important issues.
No, I'm excited about it.
All right, let's go to Matilda in New Mexico, listening on 98.9 FM. Matilda, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Okay, so I'm calling because I personally, I think that the coronavirus vaccine is the mark of the beast. But I just want to, I guess, get clarification on the signs when the mark will be coming or if that vaccine is the mark of the beast.
Thank you, Matilda.
Sure, Matilda. And what I would say is that the church does not have a specific teaching about what specifically the book of Revelation is referring to when it talks about the mark of the beast. But the beast is a figure that appears in the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation. And it is involved with deception and leading people away from God and towards Antichrist. And so John's revelation is highly symbolic, many symbolic elements here. And we have to understand that what we know about the beast is that the numbers of his name add up to 666. And it says those who worship the beast, they will receive a mark on their forehead, be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let him who has understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666. Other manuscripts have 616. And I would say, well, what evidence would we have that the COVID vaccine is the mark of the beast? I would say, well, I don't see any evidence there. I think one of the best hypotheses for who the beast is would have been John was talking about the Emperor Nero, who was also would be affiliated with Antichrist, that the emperor was worshipped as God, persecuted Christians. The number, his Roman name added up to 666 or 616 based on how you count. And the mark, my colleague Jimmy Akin has written a wonderful article about this. He's discussed this in a previous episode of Catholic Answers Live, and he thinks that just as the book of Ezekiel talks about an invisible mark placed on believers by angels, the mark of the beast as a counterpoint to that would be a kind of spiritual mark upon the followers of the beast itself. Now, I would just say this, Matilda, we look at the COVID vaccine, I would say, well, what would that have to do with the mark of the beast? It's a medicine to prevent a disease. You don't get the vaccine on your, you don't get injected with the vaccine on your forehead or your right hand. You would get it in your arm. And there's been currently nothing saying that people can't engage in commerce unless they have the vaccine. You could always even order things online without it, but there's no reason to think people will be prohibited from engaging in commerce or things like that unless they've received it. But even still, it's not a, it doesn't fall under that. I don't see a good reason to associate it with that. So does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, Matilda. All right.
Perfect. And one other point I would raise that Jimmy has raised is that God in his wisdom would not allow his people to just be simply deceived by something like this. There would be clear signs that in choosing this mark, you would be forsaking God and worshiping something else that is not God. And you're not doing that if you receive the COVID-19 vaccine.
Matilda, I'm so glad you gave us the opportunity to talk about that. I know many people have been talking about it, and thank you so much. I hope you'll call again as more questions come up. We're going to go to Omaha, Nebraska now, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Chrissy, Chrissy, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Thank you so much. I'd like to ask Trent a question. What is the difference between agnostic and atheism?
Okay.
Sure. It depends who you ask, because the words mean different things to different people. But traditionally, in the history of philosophy, an atheist, well, I guess the difference would be summarized in how you answer this question. Does God exist? So there's three ways you could answer the question. Yes, no, or maybe, / I don't know. So if you say yes, God does exist, you would be a theist. If you say no, God does not exist, you deny the existence of God, you would be an atheist. And if you say I don't know if God exists or maybe God exists, then you would be an agnostic. That's the traditional definition. But most modern atheists will say that they are atheists, but they're really agnostics. They would say they don't believe in God, but they're not going to claim there is no God. And I don't necessarily want to argue with them about terms unnecessarily, but it's important for them to see, okay, is your answer to the question of God, is it no, he doesn't exist, or maybe he does? If it's maybe, if it's a possibility, then you should be more of an agnostic than an atheist. So I hope that's a sufficient answer for your question.
Does that work, Chrissy?
Yes, that will. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very glad that you called. 888-318-7884, our number. Man, lines are very, very full, so we will just keep moving. Let's go to Alabama now. Watching on Facebook Live is John in Alabama. John, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Oh, thank you guys very much for having me. Trent, I'm a huge fan of yours. I have two of your books.
Thank you.
Anyway, so my question is how do I respond to certain skeptics online when they will quote church fathers like Saint Clement and say there's sexist comments in their quotes? Like, for example, Saint Clement of Alexandria said, "Women's very consciousness of their own nature must invoke feelings of shame." And when they say, when these comments come out, there's usually more than one of them, you know, that it's all
right.
Whole list. They'll hammer you all at time, you know, all at one time. And it's, really hard to address
right.
So many things being thrown at me at one time. But, I just would like, your opinion, how to answer a specific question of, you know, like Saint Clement when he says a woman's very consciousness of their own nature must invoke a
right.
feeling of shame.
Okay.
Right.
Let's,
and so, John, I think I would say, okay, what does this prove that this Catholic who lived 2,000 years ago said this statement about women or about certain groups that we would no longer hold to be true today? What would follow from that? You could say, okay, this guy was wrong in what he said about women. What does that prove about the Catholic Church? The Catholic Church does not say everything a church father said is infallible. Far, far from it. The church fathers are not infallible. They are witnesses of sacred tradition that has been passed through their writings. So they are a witness to sacred tradition. But the church fathers themselves, they are not sacred tradition. They are witnesses to it. Their writings are not infallible. They can make mistakes about things. And I would say that our understanding of the nature of the equality and roles between men and women, human beings, sometimes they grow in morality, not just in their own lives, but over the course of human history, they grow in their understanding of how to take gospel principles and apply them to the world. And so I think you could point to the Bible to say, well, does the Bible teach that men and women are equals? And I would say, well, yes, it doesn't. It says men and women are equal. Galatians 3:28 says there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, man, male nor female. We're all one in Christ Jesus. God chose to be man through a woman. He chose to be born of a woman. Those who say the church is sexist, I would say to them, if the church is sexist, why do we exalt say that the creature of all of God's creation, the part of creation that deserves the most praise is a woman, the Blessed Virgin? So that's one route that I might take. I might say, well, what does this prove? You can only disprove the Catholic Church if you could show the Catholic Church officially taught something that was like intrinsically evil, and it doesn't when it comes to men and women. Number two, John, I would turn the question back on them to say, it sounds like you're saying it is always wrong to be sexist, as if this is a moral fact of the universe, that we ought, no matter our time and culture, we ought not be sexist. And I would say, all right, where does that moral fact come from? If it's just your opinion, why should anyone care about your opinion? But if it is a fact that all people are equals, then we have to say what makes us equal. Only God creating us in his image can explain that fact.
Oh, you did a little turnaround.
I hope that's helpful.
John, thanks. I appreciate the call. Lots more folks on the line, so we're going to try to get to everybody before we have to go. Trent Horn, our guest, open forum today on Catholic Answers Live.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Bishop Joseph Strickland of Tyler, Texas, is one of the most courageous leaders in the church, known for his outspoken support of unborn life, Orthodox faith and morals, and reforming Catholic institutions. In his groundbreaking new book, Light and Leaven, he offers a forthright perspective on the state of the church today and calls on the lay faithful to meet its challenges boldly. Touching on topics including parish renewal, the centrality of the Eucharist, the need for prayer and silence in a noisy and distracted age, and the battle between good and evil in the church and world, Bishop Strickland's wise insights and evident love for souls will inspire and edify you. To order your copy of Light and Leaven, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest, Trent Horn. You might know him from his podcast, Council of Trent, which you can find at trenthornpodcast.com. You might know him from one of his 73 books, including the Bible. No, I was going to say the Bible is a Catholic book. That's the one book I got here on the desk that's not his. Persuasive Pro-Life, Answering Atheism, the one where there's like things the saints never said. That's a great one. Trent Horn, our guest, and big news. You're going to be able to find Trent's podcast on YouTube, which I think is just great. And you know what I have to say, Trent? I don't want to say this in a way that's critical of anyone, But I like that your podcast is so civil. I feel like as Catholics in the public sphere, if we're going to be on social media, if we're going to be doing podcasts and stuff, it shouldn't be like ripping on people and using, I don't know, I see a lot of negativity in Catholic media right now. And I love that you'll talk to anybody yeah. about anything in a civil way.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting, Cy? There are Catholic podcasters and media out there who have very negative views towards the church, even though they are Catholic. And I think it is fine to be offer respectful criticism of church leaders. I think that's fine. But, you know, so they're going to do that. I want to equip Catholics to go and help Catholics return to the faith and help non-Catholics become Catholic. Now, what's interesting, though, Cy, is that many of those commenters who are very critical of the hierarchy, and sometimes in a mean-spirited way, it's interesting that they don't, I don't really see them very often engage in dialogue with non-Catholics.
Yeah.
It's very rare. I don't see them just sit down with an atheist or a Protestant for a dialogue on the differences between them, or they don't. And I don't think that's healthy. We need to be able to evangelize, dialogue, public formal debate. I think these are all very good things. So with you know, different people based on the appropriate venues and forums, So I think that would be and so what I strive to do on my podcast, whether I'm having a dialogue or I'm just talking about an issue, I just want to be fair and charitable. Though I may have my own personal opinion on matters, and sometimes I have a very strong opinion, but that doesn't mean you have to lose charity when you're discussing things.
888-318-7884, our number here. Danny in Jacksonville, Florida, watching on YouTube Live. You are up next. Danny, go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi. I've been watching a lot of your videos lately. Really enjoy them. And my question is to whenever skeptics bring up the question of the reliability of the New Testament because of two specific things, one being that they were written anonymously, and two, they were written several decades after the lifetime of Jesus.
Right.
How should I address those two points, that they were written anonymously and written well after Jesus' lifetime?
Okay. Thanks, Danny.
Right. I would ask them, Danny, to say, all right, what is your standard for a document in the ancient world to be reliable? I would say, you give me the standard when it comes to both how we determine the authorship of a work and how long after the events it describes it was composed. So I might say, look, are you saying a book is not reliable if it was written more than 20 years, or let's say, you know, more than 40 years after the events it purports to describe, 40 or 50 years. If it was written, let's say, 100 years later, if that's the case, then they're going to have to discount the vast majority of ancient history. You know, for example, the claim that Hannibal crossed the Alps with war elephants was written down 50 or 60 years later by a Roman historian. The accounts of Alexander the Great, his biography, was 400 years later. The first accounts we have of William Wallace in England from the movie Braveheart are from a blind minstrel that were written 150 years later. So the problem is, I would ask them, what's your standard? And if the Gospels don't meet your standard, you're going to have to throw out almost all of ancient history as well. If you don't throw out ancient history, then that means you have a double standard for the Bible then, which is unacceptable. So, and I would say, though, when it comes to written within a few decades of the events they describe, that is still within the framework for eyewitnesses to accurately record events. I was watching on the Library of Congress, they had old videos of World War I veterans that were recorded in the 80s and 90s. These are people who are talking about events that happened 70 or 80 years later that were as clear as if they had just been there yesterday. So if we trust that, then I would say, all right, do you trust people who describe when they fought? Like, if you talk to a Vietnam War veteran today, would you say he couldn't possibly remember Vietnam? He couldn't. No, we wouldn't say that. They could remember it, even though that occurred 50 years ago. And that would put us in the same framework as the apostles. But I would say, the Gospels were written, there's good evidence that that Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written before 70 AD. And I talk about that in my book, The Case of Counterfeit Christ. As for the authorship, Danny, I would say to them, how do they know the Gospels are anonymous? They might say, well, the Gospels in their text never say who their author is. It's just ascribed to it. I would then ask them, how is it that in the ancient church we have never found a manuscript saying that one gospel was actually written by somebody else? The manuscripts always align. It's always Mark's gospel, always has the gospel of Mark at the top of it. And by the way, if they were anonymous, strictly speaking, why would you pick nobodies like Mark or Luke or lower tier apostles like Matthew? Why would you pick these if you're just kind of, you know, the gospels that are made up usually have names like Philip and Peter and things like that. That doesn't discount John's gospel. We have very good historical evidence for John. But I would just critique that idea. So that's just a few thoughts there. I would also recommend to you, Danny, a book called The Case for Jesus by Brant Petrie. I think it's called The Case for Jesus. Let me just make sure. But he has a whole series of chapters on the reliability of the gospels. Well, two books. One is Craig Blumberg, Reliability of the Gospels, and the other is The Case for Jesus by Brant Petrie, is what I would recommend for you. So is that a helpful reply?
Mostly. Just kind of adding on to that.
Sure.
Because they also bring up the fact that, you know, if it is anonymous, because I have read a few, historical papers, and a lot of them do say that there is good reason. I don't remember the specifics of them, but there are good reasons to think they're anonymous and that they were compiled and written off of oral tradition. And that's the other part of why some skeptics claim, because it was passed through oral tradition.
Right.
That's just the other aspect of it.
Yeah, and what I would say, Danny, is that, I mean, there's going to be liberal, you can hold that view and still be Catholic. There are liberal Catholic biblical scholars who claim that the Gospels are anonymous and weren't really written by Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. Though I would say, though, that the consensus of the church's history places a very, very heavy weight on that consensus of who the authors were. So I would take from that, they say, well, they are anonymous. I'd still press them. Well, what are your reasons for it? Because when we have like the letter to the Hebrews, for example, I would say that is an anonymous letter. We don't know who the author is. We know it has an apostolic origin to it somehow. But people in the early church ascribed it to a variety of individuals. We never see that with the Gospels. Now, it's true, the Gospels don't name their own authors. And some people say, well, Matthew refers to himself in the third person. So clearly Matthew didn't write Matthew. Well, Josephus refers to himself in the third person, and he was a Jewish historian that lived in the first century. Matthew includes a lot of Mark's material, so Matthew couldn't have written it. Well, Mark was the traveling companion of Peter. So it would make sense for Matthew, as a lower tier apostle, to go straight to the source, somebody who was in close contact with Peter, the leader of the church, and who, the person who was one of the closest people to Jesus during his earthly ministry. Now, with oral tradition, I would say to them, look, this isn't a case of tradition being handed down over hundreds of years being distorted. A.N. Sherwin White was a Greco-Roman historian who said that it takes more than two generations for myth to overtake the historical core of a narrative that is passed on through oral tradition. And we know the Gospels were written within one generation of the lifetime of Jesus's followers. So check out Blumberg, Historical Reliability of the Gospels, and Brant Petrie, The Case for Jesus. My book, Counterfeit Christ, might also... Well, Danny, let's get your email or your address. We'll send you Counterfeit Christ. You might also enjoy that as well. So,
thanks, Danny. Got to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
C St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with program info, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. Just go to ewtn.com/wings. Fill out your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. When you get yours, send it to all your friends, and they can send it to their friends. And pretty soon, we're covering the whole world with the good news about EWTN. Wings, the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Our friend Father Sebastian Walsh has produced another very fine book for Catholic Answers Press. You probably remember Secrets from Heaven, the great book he did on the parables and sayings of Jesus. And this time he's got one for helping your kids stay Catholic. And if they have left, bringing them back. It's called Always a Catholic, How to Keep Your Kids in the Faith for Life and Bring Them Back If They've Strayed. You can get 25% off Always a Catholic right now, today, if you go to shop.catholic.com. Always a Catholic. Oh, no, you know what? They have a special website for it, alwaysacatholic.com. That's even easier. Just go to alwaysacatholic.com, get 25% off in order to get your copy of the brand new book from Father Sebastian Walsh. Our guest this hour is Trent Horn. Trent Horn, an extraordinary apologist for us here at Catholic Answers and author of many books and the proprietor of, I always want to say TrentHornPodcast.com, but he's the proprietor of The Council of Trent. That's his podcast, and you can find it at TrentHornPodcast.com. Up next in Toledo, Ohio, listening on Annunciation Radio is Tim. Tim, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Trent Horn. Hi, Tim.
Tim? Hello?
Tim in Toledo? Okay. And I guess what? I pushed the right button. It's not me this time. I love it when there's something goes wrong and it's not my fault. Let's go to Matthew in Pennsylvania. That's probably sounded kind of petty. Matthew in Pennsylvania, watching on YouTube Live. And Tim, by the way, we'll come back to you in a minute, so don't hang up. We're going to come back to you and give you another try. Matthew in Pennsylvania, are you there with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can, yeah. Go ahead with your question for Tim. I mean, for Trent.
All right. thank you for having me, by the way. I had a quick question. I've heard, a lot of people, like I've been online, in, you know, debate service and, I've heard a lot of, controversy around John Paul II. And they sent a quote, and this is from the Vatican website, from John Paul II. And it shows him, praying to St. John the Baptist, asking St. John the Baptist to protect Islam. So I guess the controversy around it is why would he ask St. John the Baptist to protect Islam that's like an evil, you know, religion, so to say.
All right. Well,
right. Yeah, so I see the quote here. This comes from a pilgrimage the Holy Father made in the year 2000 to the Holy Land. And he was visiting, I think, an area in Jordan called Wadi al-Qarar. And so he was speaking about John the Baptist. And so he was speaking about the readings there. And he was primarily addressing the Catholic community of Jordan that had gathered there to hear his address, but he also says, I cordially greet the representatives of other communities who have come from many other parts of the Middle East. I am grateful to you all. He says a special greetings to His Royal Highness Prince Mohammed, who was probably the royal figure leader in Jordan at that time. He says, I will keep all the people of Jordan, Christians and Muslims, in my prayers, especially the sick and the elderly. With gratitude, I invoke abundant blessings upon His Highness the King and upon the whole nation. God bless you all. God bless Jordan. So this is something he seems to be saying off the cuff of his, you know, off the top of his head as he's ending an address and probably leaving their presence. May St. John Baptist, notice here, I mean, he doesn't even say may St. John the Baptist. He says, may St. John Baptist protect Islam and all the people of Jordan and all who participated in this celebration, a memorable celebration. I'm very grateful to all of you. So what do we make from this? I do not think this means that John Paul II wanted St. John the Baptist to help Islam flourish as a religion for people to not become Christian and to be Muslim instead. I don't see any good evidence that that is what Pope St. John Paul II intended. Rather, I think there's a lot of other hypotheses of what he meant by this. Given the nature of the response, he may have misspoke, just like he didn't say St. John the Baptist, but he said St. John Baptist. He might have meant, may St. John the Baptist protect Muslims and all the people of Jordan. He's talking about people rather than systems. And it's also apropos for him to say, may St. John the Baptist protect you, because even amongst Muslims, there is persecution, violence. Just as St. John the Baptist lost his head, there are people who would lose their heads in the Middle East for even infighting among Muslims. So he cared a lot about peace and stability in the region. So I think what's probably going on here is that he just kind of misspoke, and he's saying, look, I want all of you who are here, especially the Muslims who came to hear me, the Pope, speak, who would normally say I'm an idolater, may God protect you from whatever is going on, and God watch over you. He also may be saying that maybe he wants, I guess that's what I think he's saying. You could say, well, if he's talking about Islam as a whole, maybe he's saying, may God protect the Muslim faith in the sense of continuing to move it towards truth and protecting the truth that is within Islam, that there's only one God, for example. You know, we're not polytheists or monotheists. There's one God, and that God has revealed himself in the Old and the New Testaments and moving Islam to ultimate truth. That's another route, but I would say the one that's off the table for me is that John Paul II is a heretic and wants people to become Muslims. I think it makes more sense he just kind of misspoke and was praying for the protection of Muslims in general and trying to show goodwill to the Muslims that came to hear him speak in Jordan that day. And so I think it's important just to remember that and to know that the Pope, look, he's not infallible when he gives. We talked about this with Francis for a long time. When the Pope gives addresses, sometimes he says things in a great way, sometimes he says them in a not great way. But he's still the Pope. Is that a helpful reply, Matthew?
Yeah, actually, that is.
You seem surprised, Matthew. Like actually, but a lot of times Trent gives helpful answers. This is not a first time. I got to say thanks though, Matthew, because we're very short on time, and there are lots of people on the line. I got to go to Christopher right here in California, watching on YouTube Live. Christopher, go ahead with your question for Trent Horn.
Hi there. It's kind of a two-part question, the first of which is about the historicity of Exodus. From what I understand, it's relatively questionable and in some cases isn't supposed to be interpreted literally. So assuming that's correct, though, doesn't that kind of undermine or undercut at least the significance of what Jesus does that follows in the New Testament? Things like the Eucharist, which is kind of like the manna from heaven 2.0 or the sacrificial lamb 2.0 kind of thing.
All right.
Yeah, hopefully that makes sense.
It did. I thought it did. Makes sense to you, Trent?
Yeah, it does. And so when it comes to the historicity of the Exodus, Christopher, I think there are different propositions. I think some people who criticize the Exodus, what they're attacking is more of how some people will read the Bible. And they'll say that, well, the Bible says there are 1 million Jews left Israel. Left Egypt and wandered in the desert for 40 years. And so they'll say there's no evidence of such a large group of people migrating in the ancient world. And we don't, what their arguments against the historicity of the Exodus are not, here's evidence it didn't happen. Usually it's just, well, we don't have corroborating evidence in documents or in archaeological finds that it did happen. So they're making an argument from silence. And I would be very cautious of this because I believe there is evidence for the historicity of the Exodus, even in the absence of evidence that skeptics bring up. So a few thoughts on that. First, this has happened before. In the 19th century, biblical scholars claimed the Bible was wrong about the Hittites. They said there's no evidence the Hittites ever existed, and so the Bible was wrong about them. But then archaeological evidence for the Hittites was discovered in the late 19th century, and the Bible was vindicated. Something similar could happen for the Exodus. There's archaeological finds, I think the tomb of Cleopatra and the tombs of other people who are described in a lot of Egyptian literature. We haven't found those archaeological elements. We would not expect to find. Now, I would say that it was probably not a million people who left Egypt for Israel. It could have been a very small number of people. And the word we translate, and there's a translation issue that we're talking about, not 600,000 men, but like 600 clans or 600 families, or the large numbers are a way just to speak of the importance of Israel, and they're not actually literal, that in the ancient world, people use numbers for all kinds of non-literal means. And so there's a small group of families that left. Let's say it was 600 of them that were slaves. They left and then established themselves in Canaan. Well, we do have evidence from archaeology and other documents of Semitic speaking people in the Egyptian Delta. We have evidence of these people interacting with Egyptian officials, of kind of a wandering band of people called they're called the Habiru, H-A-B-I-R-U. I'm not saying these were the Hebrews, but the Habiru were a kind of nomadic wandering tribe that were Semitic that the Hebrews may have been a part of that. So there's a lot there. I wouldn't expect to find a lot of archaeological evidence because you've got a small number of people traveling through the wilderness with materials that are going to degrade over time. There used to be billions of passenger pigeons in the U.S. We've only found like 100 fossils of them, even though billions of them used to live here in the United States. I talk about this at length, Christopher, in my book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties. So I'm happy to send you that book. I would also so let's get your information and I'll send that to you. I would also recommend two books on the question by a very good Egyptologist, James Hoffmeyer. One is called Israel in Egypt, The Evidence for the Authenticity of the Exodus, and the other is Ancient Israel in Sinai, The Evidence for the Wilderness Narratives. Both are written by James Hoffmeyer, very good Egyptologist. So I'd recommend both, but we'll send you a copy of Hard Sayings, which has a section on the historicity of the Exodus.
Thanks, Christopher. I'm going to keep moving. I want to get somebody else on, at least one more on, before we have to go with Trent. Let's go to Michael in Dallas, Texas, watching on YouTube. Michael, we're very glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me on your show. Mr. Horn, I would just like to say it is my absolute pleasure to be speaking with you right now.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the work that you've done in the pro-life community and representing the unborn. It's just unparalleled. So thank you for all your labor.
Thank you.
My question for you is, I believe that abortion should be illegal. I believe it's a heinous act and it should be illegal. But I wanted to get your thoughts on how should we go about dealing punishment if it is indeed made illegal for either women who continue to get abortions anyway or doctors who perform them.
Right. And so what I would say is that if abortion becomes illegal, if a majority of people agree that abortion should become illegal, this question is interesting that some people try to treat it as an argument against the pro-life position, that people will say, oh, you couldn't agree to punishing people women who choose abortion, doctors who choose abortion. That's something they can't fathom, and it is difficult to fathom in a culture that generally supports legal abortion. But keep in mind, if we reach the point where abortion was made illegal, the only way to sustain that in a democratic republic like ours would be through a massive consensus that it ought to be illegal and the force of law should rest behind it. Now, what should the punishment be? Well, it depends. Like the killing of born people, the punishment for killing a born person is not uniform. Some people who kill born people get life in prison. Other people who kill born people, they don't even go to jail at all. They're given mental health treatment. They go on probation. So I would say it really depends. I would say there should be a different punishment for doctors who know what this is and profit from it and engage in it, and women who choose it for a variety of circumstances. I would say that we would probably treat, in a time when abortion is illegal, we should treat women and men who participate in this procedure and procure it with the same way that we treat women and men who kill infants. Some cases of infanticide are severely prosecuted. Other cases of infanticide, we recognize emotional distress and harm, and we seek mental health for the person who is engaged in it. So I would say that if we made abortion illegal, we could craft feticide laws that are on par with laws dealing with infanticide that are more common in other countries. So I hope that's a helpful answer.
And I will just say thank you, Michael. I appreciate that. And a very hearty thank you to Trent Horn. Thanks for doing 2 whole hours with us today, Trent. It's great to have you back.
Yes, happy to be here. Looking forward to doing more shows.
Maybe tomorrow.
You know, I think I will be on tomorrow. I'm doing a lot this week. It'll be fun.
Yeah, okay. You and I'm glad you responded positively, because I would be a bummer if you said, no, I'm not, because we'd have to find somebody else. But it's you and Carlo tomorrow. We're going to have a lot of fun, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.